I'm very happy that I have the opportunity to talk about a work that I've done in collaboration with Posteinhardt from Princeton and Avi Loeb from Harvard. The problem we attack in this paper is the unpredictability problem that arises in primordial cosmology. It's well known that there are two kinds of unpredictability problems. The one is the multiverse unpredictability problem. I won't talk about that problem in this talk. I will only talk about a second kind of problem, which I think is at least as severe as the multiverse unpredictability problem. And this is the parameter unpredictability problem. Let me immediately give you an example of what I mean by this. Just look at this potential. This is a single field inflationary potential with three parameters, m, lambda, and theta. This potential has been very popular since, especially since the Planck data. The interesting thing is that just by using these three parameters, or just by fitting these three parameters, you can basically reach any NS r and d rho by rho yu. And this means it is a problem since no observation will rule out such a potential. That means we have a problem, this a theory that has this feature being non-falsifiable is not really scientific. So if we want to have a real scientific theory, yes?
I'm just curious. I know this is a minor point, but
yes?
How would you get constraints on three parameters when NS and R, there are only two observables?
Okay, so what you can do is, first of all, fix d rho over rho by using m, so that you have the right spectrum of the perturbation, 10 to the minus 5. And then you can solve, since you have two other observables, you can write down the two equations. So because you have still more two other parameters left, you have two equations, two free parameters, or two free degrees of freedom, therefore you can fit. Yes. Was it an answer to your question? I hope so. So I will show you how it goes. This will be part of my talk. The main thing is if the number of your observables corresponds to the number of your parameters, if you have at least as many parameters as the number of your observables, then you can fit any data. This is a problem. Yes. That's why I think.
Not surprising in terms of counting parameters. It's just that you could have hoped that they would have let in some restricted, they would have projected on some restricted range of the RNNS plane, and that it does not.
Exactly. So, interesting thing is these parameters are extremely finely tuned. So, just a small variation, for example, of theta would lead you to a model that has either two bumps, so two minima. Or it would be a strictly parallel, like yielding your results that are not anymore compatible with Planck. But this is just an example. I want to attack this problem. So what I want to show you how to get inflationary models that are falsifiable, that don't fit any data. Before I present you the results or the strategy, let me just point out the method I will use. I apply a hydrodynamic approach, and I use this because this is model independent, so I don't need to make any assumptions about the microphysics. I want to stay close to observations, and therefore, I will not be talking about many fields, multi-fields or single-field inflationary models. I will now be talking about a smoothing fluid component. This is so you can express the underlying idea of inflation in terms of introducing a smoothing fluid component that goes like a to the 2 epsilon, where epsilon is defined as the equation of state parameters, 3 halves times w plus 1, where w is the equation of state. So here I assume the perfect fluid, which is a good approximation, as we know, for early universe cosmology. Now, in order to understand what our constraints needs to be on epsilon, it's very helpful to write out the Friedmann equations. Maybe this is a form you are not mostly familiar with. Here in this Friedmann equation, there are curvature and anisotropy components included, because we know that in primordial cosmology, we want to have, on large scales, we want to have something that smooths you on large scales and at the same time creates the perturbations with the nearest scale invariant spectrum. Now, if you're in an expanding phase, then you know that the most dangerous member in this equation is the curvature. Since if you can suppress curvature by way of using your smoothing fluid components, which is a new one, then you can suppress any other members in this equation on the right-hand side of this equation, since they don't grow as fast as the curvature goes. Just because I will also be talking about the cyclic model, in a contracting phase, it's exactly the opposite. The curvature is the least dangerous guy here, because the most dangerous one is the one which grows with the highest power, 8 to the 16th in the contracting phase, A gets smaller. Therefore, you need to watch out for the member in this equation that has the highest power, because here anisotropy will grow fastest. So, and amazingly enough, this single equation and the single idea is sufficient to define the constraints or the conditions for a successful inflationary model using the hydrodynamical language. Because what we need is, we know, in order to suppress the curvature term, we need epsilon, where I assume the epsilon not to be constant, but a slowly varying function of n, which is the number of e-folds remaining until the end of inflation. So in order to suppress the curvature term, I know that my epsilon needs to be smaller than 1 for the inflationary phase. And the second condition is that I have an exit, at least a local exit from inflation. That means at some point this condition needs to break down, and this will give me the total amount of inflation. At n equals 0, it breaks down, and where it started is my total amount of inflation. And until it doesn't break down, it's smaller than 1. Okay, so just let me clarify two things. Since I use epsilon as a function, so an equation of state parameter as a function of n, usually epsilon is used in inflationary theory as a parameter, as a number. So the connection is the inflationary epsilon parameter is my epsilon for the y u n equals 60. And similarly, you are familiar with the inflationary eta. And this is defined in my case. So usually, you don't immediately see that there is a connection in between them. But if you make epsilon to be a function of n, then you can write the inflation epsilon as the d log epsilon over dn for the y u n equals 60. Now, I just drew it because it's nice to see it. So if you have it's just an example for an epsilon function. It's a typical epsilon for inflation. It's for almost all inflationary stages is constant. That's why we want it to be constant, because then we can have a slowly varying epsilon and use our underlying idea. And here you also see this is then eta as your d log epsilon over dn. It's mostly evaluated at n60, sometimes for n50 or in between. Now the problem is, because my main interest is to track back where is the root of the unpredictability problem. The problem is that inflation only puts a constraint on the y's of epsilon as a function of n. But it doesn't tell you what kind of shape it can have. And since it can have any arbitrary shapes until it fulfills the conditions, therefore you could also imagine that epsilon looks like this. It's very different. But nothing prohibits you from having such an epsilon. And that means that you get this unpredictability problem, since as long as you can fulfill your numerical constraint, you can define arbitrary shape of epsilon. Now, how to restore predictability? I think we have already the answer, because if we know that we don't have enough constraint on the shape, or don't have any constraint on the shape of epsilon, we need a principle, an additional assumption, that will collapse the possible shapes we can have, so any shape we can have on epsilon, to a certain family of shapes. And if you look out for such an additional principle, the most obvious is, I think, scale-freeness. Why? First of all, it is the observationally best motivated principle, because from the microwave background observations, we see that the universe is extremely simple and on large scale, scale-free. And secondly, it's even more interesting that it was also the underlying idea of inflation historically. So it's a historically and observationally well-motivated principle. Now, what does it mean, scale-free? Scale-free means that the physics, by way of which I describe my theory, is simple power law up to a coordinate shift. And this is what I wanted. So I found what I wanted, since if I say inflation, in addition, should be scale-free, that means the underlying physics should be scale-free that describes inflation, then I can collapse the possible shapes of my equation of state parameter to be a simple polynomial when, in order to fulfill the constraint that it should be smaller than 1 for the inflationary stage, I know that it needs to be of a form 1 over n plus 1 to the alpha. And why 1 over n plus 1, not some number times some beta times n plus 1? Why? Because it needs to end at exactly at n equals 0. And that fixes my prefactor. So what I reach now is that I have a theory that is predictive. And I want to show why it's predictive. Well, first of all, it uniquely determines my inflationary background. If I use the second Friedman equation in this form, then and the definition of the number of e-folds, dn equals minus d log a, then I can express epsilon as d log h over dn. And from this equation, I can solve for h so that I have h, or the energy density of inflation, as a function of the number of e-folds. So I have a background that entails only a single parameter. And if I plot my results, then I get a very interesting spectrum of curves. I see that my inflation model split up into 3 classes. Let me just mention here why or what is the main characteristic of the respective classes. First of all, for alpha equals or smaller than 1, I have Poirot-like inflation. What does it mean? The energy scale of inflation is not bounded above. And I can basically start inflation at arbitrarily high energies, even at the Planck density. A second class is a plateau-like class. Watch out that it starts with alpha equals 1.5, but it's characteristic for alphas which are bigger than 1.5. And the red curve is not the characteristic curve of this class, but this almost that flat curves are characteristic for the models, which I call plateau-like models. That means we immediately see that these curves are bounded above with respect to their energy. And that also means that here, if you have a plateau-like inflation, so in the hydrodynamical language, then your inflation cannot start at arbitrarily high energies. And you also see that these models, some are nearly that flat for almost all ends, and only have here at the end a feature in order to finish inflation or in order to end inflation. And I have in between a so-called intermediate class, where it looks like for the last 60 e-folds that they behave as if they were power law models. In fact, they are not, because if I look or watch out for their behavior for higher numbers of e-folds, then I will see that they flatten out and are also bounded above with respect to the energy scale. I will come back to this in a second. Yes?
So this is a one parameter family.
Yes.
Potentials parameterized by this power law for epsilon.
Yes.
Why is that like a more natural, saying that epsilon is a power law in n? Why is that one parameter model like more natural, let's say, taking the potential to be a power law?
So first of all, just a small correction. Maybe this is important to say. So I'm not working with potentials. I'm working in the hydrodynamical language, so I'm not using the potential language. Therefore, I'm taking here a single parameter. And why is it more natural? I think the less number of parameters you have, the more predictive is your theory. I will show it to you when we come to the perturbations, because then all of your observables will be described in terms of a single parameter. I can, I will do it. I hope that we will have time. I just don't want to do it, because then I immediately assume something about the microphysics of my theory, that it is described by a scalar field, and it's a single field model, not a multi-field model. As long as I stay in the hydrodynamic language, I don't need to make these additional assumptions. And second, why it's well motivated to use the hydrodynamics in adding scale-freeness as my additional assumption, because scale-freeness is something that is a feature of the life scale structure. So this is better motivated. And there is a third argument for why to choose epsilon. epsilon is dimensionless, while potential would always be dimensional. That means because I want to have scalar physics, the most natural function I could choose should be, if I can make it, dimensionless as well. So these are the arguments. And the less number of parameters I can have, the more predictive is my theory. Let me show this to you by making the predictions for the at perturbative level. This is a well-known result that I can express ns minus 1 in terms of epsilon and its log derivative. And if I substitute with my power law form, then I have an expression for ns just in terms of one parameter. So as we see, background and perturbations are described by one parameter. But you also might ask, OK, but this is not strict power law for almost all alpha, except for alpha equals 1. And that's true. So should we only consider a one-parameter model in the sense of alpha needs to be 1, because I require also at perturbative level to be strictly scale-free? Or can I allow for something what I call background-only scale-free, where I allow for all alphas which are bigger than 1? And I argue, yes, I should allow for this second option as well, since, as I just mentioned, scale-freeness is a feature of the background. And because the deviation, as you see, is almost unobservably small, because for example, alpha bigger 1, always the second component dominates, while for almost alpha smaller than 1, always the first component dominates for almost all scales, therefore, and this is at perturbative level. It is well motivated within my theory to include the models which have alpha non-equal 1, but to call them background-only scale-free in making this distinction. The interesting thing is, again, that this kind of family, or this family of inflationary models, give you a real prediction, gives you a real prediction what kind of spectrum you can expect in inflationary theory. You will have a red tilt, and you will have a minimum deviation from the Harrison-Sheldovich-Peebles spectrum. I made a calculation for 60. I could have made it for 50 as well. The important thing is that an S has a maximum value for alpha equals 1.5. You just need to take the derivative of function with respect to alpha. And if you substitute for n equals 60, then you see that it's an extremely nice value, because it's 0.97. And this is it's a WMAP value and very close to the Planck value as well, mean value as well. Just a short remark, if you don't make any additional assumptions, inflation could also have a blue spectrum. So nothing tells you, without any additional assumption, what kind of spectrum you should have. So it's, in general, not a prediction of inflation to have red tilt. This is interesting, because it's quite often considered as a very generic prediction of inflation, and that's, in fact, not true. And I can also make the second prediction, since we know that R, the tensor to scalar ratio, can also be expressed in terms of epsilon. And what I have now is an expression for the background, the tilt, and the tensor to scalar ratio in terms of one parameter. So what I had up until now was good news. I could restore predictability by introducing an observationally very well motivated additional principle to inflation. However, what I found here implies good and bad news as well. The good thing is the scale-freeness is not only good to restore predictability, it is also good to evaluate. It gives you a way how to evaluate different inflationary models. This is what I will be talking about in the next 5 or 10 minutes. However, it will also show us that inflation is not free of problems. I will talk about three different and logically independent problems: the extraparameter problems, the initial conditions problem, and the unlikeliness problem. First, the extraparameters problem. If we recall the plot, I already mentioned just a few minutes ago that the three inflationary classes are different not only with respect to the energy scale, but also with respect to their behavior. The power law-like and the intermediate models don't seem to have any feature. They seem to behave in a quiet monotonic way. However, the plateau-like models do obviously have a feature, and that is they are that flat for almost all n except for the last few e-folds. What does it mean? We can immediately assume that if I want to connect my hydrodynamic analysis to some microphysics, then the microphysics that describes this family of models will need to have some additional parameters in order to account for this feature. That means I definitely need more parameters, either more parameters or parameters that are dimensional, or a parameter that is dimensional, in case of the plateau-like models compared to the power law-like models. Now, if you want to be minimalist and if you want to have as little amount of tuning as you can in your theory, then you would say this is a problem, and I think this is a problem. But this is not the biggest problem we have. The second problem we can have with respect to different models. Yes?
Is the point you're making that in this model, as you lower R, as you keep lowering R, you have NS eventually runs away.
NS runs away? No. So if we go back, just get back the slides where I have the formula for NS. If I lower R, that means I need to have small alpha, right?
Not large.
Oh, yes, sorry. I need to have, in order to have small R, I need to have large alpha, yes. But in this case, what you see here, if I have large alpha, I can ignore this first term, because this term will dominate. The larger alpha is, the more will this term be dominating.
Oh, yeah, that's what I mean.
Yes.
So if let's imagine the observational limits in R were 100 times better.
Okay.
Then that would rule out this model? Like, this is the question.
Yes, yes, yes.
Because you'd have to make alpha very large
okay.
to accommodate small R.
Yes, 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 it's exactly true. So if R would be observation extremely small, that would make your NS basically, your NS wouldn't be within the constraint, and that would make, this is what I want to have exactly. I have a model that could be ruled out by observations. So if R turns out to be, I want to come back to this point, it's a very good point, keep this, I want to come back to this, there are scenarios where I can rule out my model. This is my main aim, yes?
So, I mean, there's one more handle that you have. If you want to stay in this hydrodynamical approach, and forget about the microphysics, but as soon as we talk about how inflation ends and the details of reheating, we kind of need to reintroduce a handle. And that would show up in this analysis as the total number of e-folds, for example. So, you know, it doesn't have to be 60, it could be some range. And so there's always some fudge there.
That's true. So, how inflation ends. Okay, so I assume here that my inflation will end between the and 60 and 50 and 60. So I don't want to manipulate it such that I can make my theory again predictive. So n is a variable and not a parameter here. This is important. So I agree that there are tricks, there could be tricks, I'm not rigorous enough with my approach to make this model unpredictive. However, I don't do that. And let me come back then to both points later, to the falsifiability and to the maximal amount of inflation. I want to come back to this. So these are very important points in my analysis. Okay, so, but let's, before I talk about this, let me mention a kind of problem that also arises for some of the inflationary models within my scale-free analysis. We all know that in order for inflation to start, the Hubble-sized patch at the energy scale where inflation starts needs to be smooth. That means it needs to be homogeneous and anisotropic. If inflation starts at the Planck density, it's not a problem because it seems somehow natural if you ignore the problems that have been pointed out by Penrose and then later by Neil Turok and Gary Gibbons, that kinetic energy dominance is always more probable. If you ignore that kinds of problems and you say, it's not a problem for us to imagine at the Planck scale, a Hubble-sized patch, which is smooth, that means homogeneous and isotropic, then you would say parallel inflationary models can start given very natural initial conditions. They can start at the Planck density, therefore your Hubble size patch, you only need a smooth Hubble size patch as the Planck density. However, if you want to have inflation in terms of an intermediate or plateau-like class, model of a plateau-like class, then you have a problem, a tuning problem. Since, as I mentioned, the energy scale of these models is bounded above. And it's so bounded above that it's three orders of magnitude lower than the Planck scale. So it starts that your inflation starts at 10 to the 16 GeV. This is a problem since if you now compare the size of the volume, smooth volume you need for inflation to start, then you discover that in volume is 10 to the 9. So 9 order of magnitudes difference compared to the parallel-like models. So it's a huge amount of tuning you will require, you will need in order to start plateau-like inflation. And now if you recall that inflation was introduced to solve the initial conditions problem, then you would say plateau-like inflation and intermediate inflation is bad because it cannot solve these problems. It requires very special initial conditions.
But I think the assumption there is that it's somehow natural to find a Planck size smooth patch. So that's, I mean, that's where this is coming from.
Maybe yes.
Why not say, oh, well, because we don't really understand the initial conditions problem.
You can always say, you can always say it can come from your fundamental theory, why it's natural to have this extremely big, smooth patch at the beginning. But unless you can give me this theory, I think it's fair to say this is a problem. So I think then we need to work hard in order to explain why the fundamental theory can give us, which is not yet out there, can give us a smooth patch that is 9 orders of magnitude bigger than what you would require for the other models. So this is, if you just compare the two models, you know that the tuning here is bigger, so you need to develop then a theory. And until we don't have the theory, I think we need to pose it as a problem. And the third point is, and now we come back to the number of E-fords, the total number of E-fords, you can also compare the different kinds of models with respect to the maximum number of E-fords that they can give you. And a way to do is to look at the sensitivity to variation in initial energy density for different kind of models. If you define x as the flux of order in the initial potential energy density, then for the parallel-like model with alpha equals 1, you get the following curve. Here, when I plot the number of the maximum number of efforts, so it's not the 60. It's the maximum number of E-folds you can have for a concrete model as a function of the flux, so the variation in your initial energy density, then you see that it doesn't really make a difference when alpha is equal to 1 if you vary a bit, if you vary a lot, or if you don't vary at all. And you would say, so this is then not a problem, but this is an uninteresting analysis. I don't think so, because already when you just move a bit away from alpha equals 1 towards alpha, for example, 1.25, which is representative of the intermediate class, you already see, well, small variations are OK, but large variations could be really troublesome. Now, why to include these variations? It's important to include these variations, especially if you think of the intermediate class or the plateau-like class, since you know that you have three orders of magnitude. You need to go down to a certain energy scale in order to start inflation in the case of those models, and that means that they cannot dominate the energy density down from the Planck scale. And the story becomes even more interesting if you include the plateau-like class. You see that for 1.5, you can allow for almost 40%. And you still have at least a workable model of inflation. You see, up until 40%, variation, you can reach 60 e-folds of inflation that you need. You can go down to 50, but it won't make a big difference. Now, but if you vary more, but you could say, okay, this might be not so likely to vary more, so this is still good, then you don't even have a workable model of inflation.
Can I just ask what is flex?
So if you take the initial energy density, whatever it is, say number A, then you multiply it by X, and this is then the variation in the initial energy density. So for example, for 100 GeV, this is not a realistic number, X times 100 would be, for example, for 80% 80, that you have still 80% of your energy density, initial energy density. For 0.4, it would be that you have 60% of your energy density.
And what are you assuming about the initial energy density? What am I multiplying this fraction by?
Okay. What I'm assuming that there is some total energy which is given to you by writing down the first Friedmann equation, that is your energy total energy density. What you have on the right-hand side of this equation, h squared equals radiation plus matter plus curvature plus anisotropy, which we won't have in expanding phase, plus the smoothing energy density. And what we know is when inflation starts, your smoothing component dominates. But until inflation starts, this component cannot dominate. And that means that, and most probably you will have radiation domination in case of the plateau-like and intermediate models from the Planck density until you reach the 10 to the 16 GeV. That means that again, I don't assume any fundamental theory. Exactly. So I don't assume that all these problems will be solved at some point. Even if that's the case, I want to think about them right now. And there are, since they cannot dominate right from the Planck scale, therefore I know that some other energy components need to be there, and they could mess up also. It's not natural to assume that they never mess up my inflationary energy density or the density of my smoothing component, and therefore I make this analysis.
And when you compute the
yes?
X, you must be assuming something about whether, so X corresponds to a fraction of the universe's energy.
Yes.
In,
yes.
Potential energy of the
photon. You asking what I use here? This is a very good question. What I use here to maximize it is dRho over rho. How big I allow dRho over rho to be? We know that we observe 10 to the minus 5, and I am very generous and say I allow only for modes that create me a dRho over rho 1 or below. And this is already, because other modes would create features in my spectrum that I would observe. So I write down dRho over rho in terms of my epsilon. And I set that epsilon of n, and I compute n max by saying for n max, my dRho over rho is 1. Only modes contribute to my inflation, to the total amount of inflation. Only modes can contribute that don't exceed dRho over, the variation of in energy density bigger than 1. And this is my assumption. And I think this is a fairly generous assumption. You could also go to 10 to the minus 1. This is what I assume.
Sorry, so is X the size of an initial spatial perturbation in the energy?
No. What I was answering now is what I assume in order to be able to say when I have my n max. And I compute first this n max in given a very naive estimate that there is no flex in the initial energy density. So I plug in some energy density. This is my h square. And then I multiply h square times x. So h square is my total energy density, the left-hand side of my Friedmann equation. I can be ignorant about the components. And then I multiply h square by x, and I compute then, and I plot then for different x the maximum number of e-folds. This is what I do. Okay, so the problem is, if you add all the models you can have, and watch out because alpha equals 2 is now the observational favored model, then you see that this is a real problem. Because already a tiny variation in the initial energy density leads you to a situation where you don't even have a workable model of inflation. So this is the interesting thing, that even though it is not an initial conditions problem, even though you have this extremely large smooth path at the beginning, that is 9 orders of magnitude bigger than your Planck density, inflation could start, but already a tiny variation in the total energy density will lead you to bad inflation. That means you will have inflation, but it won't be sufficient inflation if things are not just perfectly tuned, perfectly performed for your inflationary stage or before your inflationary stage. So this is a different kind of problem than just an initial conditions problem. This is a sensitivity problem. And I think it's an interesting problem to think about, how we could solve it. Up until now, I don't know of any solution. More importantly, though, I want to summarize the problems I pointed out with respect to the different classes I have seen in my plot. So I think that if you ask what kind of inflation do we want to have, then I think we should say Paolo-like would be the best. Why? Because if it won't have extra parameters problem, that means it requires among all scale-free inflationary models the least number of parameters. It has, in the sense, no initial conditions problem that you can start out at the Planck density. So you need, if you think of a haplotype patch at the Planck density as fairly natural, you don't need an unnatural initial condition. And it also is relatively extremely unsensitive to variation in initial energy density. That means you also don't have, you don't need to be worried about the fact you won't get sufficient inflation. Now, the intermediate class is not too bad as well, since you don't have there an extra parameters problem, as we saw. And this is also fairly insensitive to the initial conditions. However, it has an initial conditions problem in the sense that you can only start inflation at lower energy densities. And the plateau-like class is pretty bad, I think, because we know, because of this feature at the end, it will have some extra parameters. It will have an initial conditions problem, just like in the intermediate class. And it also has an unlikeness problem. So what you would expect if inflation should be a robust theory without requiring any fundamental theory, whatever, which is not yet out there, then I think we should say the paradigm itself supports Paolo-like models. But if you look at the data, then nature, if it either is nature funny and works in a way that we need to find the solutions for those problems, or inflation is in trouble in the sense that nature gives us the hint those guys are not the ones that can fit the observational data. They give us the wrong predictions. They give us either too large an S or too large R. So we could stop here now and say we start to work on these problems, or we take our other cosmology and see. Yes. Yes. Okay, the extra parameters problem arises because the plateau-like models are almost dead flat, almost constant up until the last E folds. And the problem arises if you compare the number of parameters or the number of dimensionless or dimensionful parameters one class requires compared to the others. And it is not a problem that you will need. Of course, you need at least one parameter because delta rho over rho is never given you by inflation. This is always, it always needs to be tuned. But this class of models only need this tuning. There's a single parameter, and this is, I will show you later, dimensionless. But in the plateau-like case, you see that something, some kind of microphysics needs to account for the fact that there is a feature in your model, that it's dead flat for almost all E-folds, and then it breaks down. And this is when you have a feature, then you need to assume, and I will show you that it's in fact the case if you translate it into a potential language, then you will see you either need a dimensionful parameter, which is if you think that dimensionful parameter is worse than a dimensionless, or it needs more parameters. So this is what I hope to can show you by converting my result or translating them into the potential language. So this is the extra parameter problem. Comparing the number of parameters each model require with each other. And then the Paolo-like require the least amount because it has no feature in it. And the intermediate class has no feature either, so it requires also no the but to like need some tuning. This is everything. So what I want to show you is, I don't want to stop here. I don't want to stop here because some of you, or almost all of you, I think, are more or less familiar with the cyclic and ekpyrotic models of the universe. So we have an alternative cosmology. And I think it's interesting to see if they can be made scale-free and what kind of results they produce. First of all, let me mention that cyclic ekpyrotic theory is not so different from inflation in the sense that the underlying idea is quite similar. Again, you introduce a smoothing component, and as you remember, we had there the anisotropy factor that is very dangerous in a contracting phase. That means instead of having a small epsilon, you need a big epsilon, and you need a certain number of e-folds, you just have your different variable, because in a contracting phase, it turns out that H is not constant. It is, you can only neglect H in the definition of your number of e-folds only for inflation. The right parameter here is log A times H. This would also be the right parameter for inflation, but usually we leave out H because it H and over H because it stays constant for almost all inflation. So this is the only difference, but in any other sense, the underlying idea is very similar to inflation, having just different A behavior. And therefore, what's not so well known, we have also here a parameter unpredictability problem. It is just, since not so many people are working on these models, that's, I think that's the only reason why not much more classes are out there. This kind of models have also this parameter unpredictability problem, and therefore they also require an additional principle. And why not to assume here the same kind of principle, since this is also, again, the observationally well-motivated one. Plus, it allows for evaluating cyclic and inflation by way of using the same criteria. And you again get a simple power law. Again, your pre-factor 3 is given you by your second condition, that at n equals 0, you need to break down. So again, parameter unpredictability problem can be restored, both for the background, again, just using the second and first Friedman equations, my definition for my variable, and then substituting for epsilon, I can express H squared, or my total energy density, in terms of my new variable, script n. What's more interesting is that we have only a single class of models here. So I think it's already a very interesting result, because we had the same kind of problem. We had the same kind of underlying idea. We introduced the same principle in order to fix this problem, but we get a very different result in the sense that we don't have different classes of models. All models behave in the same way. And in fact, as you see, this is even more interesting that for almost all alpha values, and these are the more realistic alpha values for the cyclic ekpyrotic models, you have virtual independence of your variable n. So this is quite interesting, I think. You have only a single class of cyclic ekpyrotic models using the scale-free principle. That also means that you won't have any of the problems you had in the inflationary case. Since there are no different classes, you cannot compare different classes with respect to the amount of ekpyrosis you get. You cannot compare different classes. You don't need to compare different classes with respect to the number of parameters that you require. And you won't need to be worried about different kinds of initial conditions your models could require. So objectively, this is an advantage. Now, are there disadvantages, for example, at perturbative level? Or is it just a better model? Well, let's see. We know that in the cyclic or ekpyrotic phase, we cannot create density perturbations that not decay. So the usual, the well-known and the currently most popular paradigm for creating perturbations is assuming a two-component fluid. One fluid component is responsible for the background evolution, and the second fluid component is responsible for the evolution of the perturbations. You can define these fluid components exactly such that they have these independent tasks. It's a very nice thing. On the one hand, on the other hand, now you could be worried because it looks more complicated. You know they create, so the density perturbation decay, therefore you need to watch out for the entropy and isocurvature perturbations before the bounds. And they will, of course, create you some kind of spectrum with a defined NS and with a defined R. And it is an additional assumption here, and it is fair to say that this assumption is not yet justified in terms of having a complete theory of the bounds, so that these kind of perturbations will be converted into density perturbations. It's really an assumption. They don't contribute to your tilt or to your R, as far as we know today, without having a real theory or a complete theory of the bounds. But they do contribute, this conversion do contribute to the FNL and GNL parameters. But since I don't consider the contribution of to FNL and GNL in my analysis at this point, therefore, I only will analyze the entropy isocurvature perturbations with this if, unless we find a complete theory of the bounds, we cannot consider the cyclic theory complete. Now, I define my background fluid component and my fluid component that is responsible for the perturbations such that they both are scale-free. I have for my background this constraint on the prefactor to be 3 because I need to add pyrosis in the last effort. I don't have this constraint for the perturbations because ekpyrosis ends in terms of the background condition breaks down. However, you could say now, so that would be a problem for your theory compared to inflation. That could be a disadvantage in saying, okay, inflation, scale-free inflation works with a single parameter. And you could say now, okay, ekpyrosis doesn't seem to work with just one parameter. It requires already 2 parameters. Oh no, in fact, 3, alpha 1, alpha 2, and beta 2. That means it's already, it can be made scale-free. It has all these background advantages, but now it looks like that it just makes up a huge parameter space. And that's not what you would expect from a good theory, from a good and predictive theory. Because you have then, again this problem, you have more degrees of freedom than the number of observables. This is not good news. But the good thing is, or the surprising thing is, that scale-freeness gives you a very robust constraint on how your parameters beta 2 and alpha 2 can be. Since if we go back to the Friedmann equation and if we just really stick with our power law principle and say that if these two, so here we have the, again, just the usual Friedmann equation, we have the different components which contribute to our total energy density, together with an isotropy and curvature. And then we have here the smoothing component, just as in the case of inflation, that was introduced in order to dominate this phase and to give you the homogeneous and an isotropic background that we observe today. Then, because we have two fluid components, we have now here two components. And first of all, you need to say, OK, if the epsilon 1 and epsilon 2 differ, then you will have a feature. Then you won't be scale-free anymore. So the nice thing is that even though it's a very simple principle, it gives you an extremely robust constraint on how your ratio epsilon 2 to epsilon 1 can be. It says it should be a simple power law. Otherwise, you get some feature, and then you get into contradiction. You get a contradiction with your own principle that should guide your theory. And therefore, as you see, it's a very nice result in the sense that you have an extremely predictive theory also in this case. You can only allow, if you want to stick with your scale-free principle, for alpha 1 equals alpha 2 values, and you can only allow for beta 2 equals 1. Otherwise, you don't get here a simple power law. Otherwise, you violate your scale-free principle. You still have ekpyrosis, but you don't have any more scale-free ekpyrosis. So again, we return to the one-parameter theory just by consistently using our starting principle. And as you see here now, I can here So these are papers which have almost mainly written here, been written here. So I think they are quite well known. This, again, nice result. NS can be expressed in terms of your equation of state parameters of the second fluid component that governs the evolution of your perturbations. And you have NS in terms of a single parameter again. And you have, again, this is very interesting, again, a very symmetrical case to the inflationary case. You see, again, only for alpha 1 equals alpha 2 equals 1, do you have strictly power law expression for your tilt. And I, again, just by the same token, allow for background on this carefulness by saying it's the deviation is really only there on unobservably small scales. And because scale-freeness is a background feature, therefore, I allow for background-only scale-freeness. And this is something that I know Leighton worked out. We know that it's unobservably small, the contribution to R. So this is something already where we don't even need the parameters. Whatever R will be measured, this is to a very, very large range, would rule out cyclic pyrotic theory as we know it today. So it doesn't give you the right result in both cases. In both cases, both in inflation and I want to come back to this. I have 10 more minutes, so I think I will be there in 5 minutes about how the predictions look both for inflation. So it gives you a slight difference in both cases, inflation and in cyclic. In the cyclic case, the alpha equals one model doesn't give you the right NS. So strict scale freeness is about one sigma, two sigmas far away from your mean value now. Okay, so this was something I think this is also interesting. What happens if I want to translate my result? Does it change anything in the potential language about my results, or can it teach me something about the potential language if I translate my results into the better known field and potential language? So there are two steps I need to perform. First of all, I need to convert my variable from n to be phi. And then second, I need to express v, so my potential as a function of n of phi. So again, straightforward to do. For the first step, I use the second Friedmann equation and the fact that h dot is minus 1/2 times rho s plus ps. I immediately get the connection to epsilon. So again, very nice. d phi over dn is just plus minus square root of 2 epsilon. And for the potential, in order to reconstruct the potential using epsilon or h as a function of epsilon or n, I need the first Friedmann equation plus my result for d phi over dt from the first step. And by plugging this in, I know h is a function of n, epsilon is a function of n. So I have v and as a function of n as a function of phi, gives me the results. So I just show you the results because this is not a complicated calculation. So it doesn't give me a result that would be different from the result I got in my hydrodynamic language. In fact, it makes the situation a bit worse, as I would say. You wouldn't see it immediately, therefore it's very helpful to plot the results. For all values, so it's again the inflationary case. If I translate my inflation results in the language of scalar field and potentials, for all alpha smaller than 1, I have an exponential potential that n, so this is not the usual exponential, has a prefactor power law, so it is an exponential that ends. I have, and this is an interesting result, scale-free inflation only gives you a single monomial potential. This is a lambda phi fourth. So in order to get, for example, m squared phi squared, you need to break scale freeness to some extent. This is also an interesting result because it picks out a single monomial potential instead of having a whole range of the so-called chaotic potentials. And for alpha between 1 and 2, I get a large field plateau model. And for alpha bigger than 2, I get a small field plateau model. So these two guys are now the observationally favored ones, and the smaller r will be pushed down, or the more r will be pushed down, the more we get into this class. Again, this class is the plateau-like class that corresponds to the three problems I pointed out. And we can do the same. This is really something I just want to mention. We can do the same with scalar fields and potentials and translate the hydrodynamic language into this. In case of the cyclic theory, we had the two fluid components. These two fluid components will correspond now to two different fields. In field space, you can just represent it as, again, two guys, one of which is responsible for your background evolution, and one of which is responsible for your perturbation evolution. The most generic form of the potential that has been pointed out a couple of years ago by Buchbinder, Khoury, and Alfrud is this. So you assume a form where your background potential is V sigma comma 0. This is your background, and then you assume that in order to have a field that only shows up at perturbative level, you need to assume that it only shows up at second order. So now what therefore, when I convert my hydrodynamic results into the potential language, I assume here now this generic form, and then compute for the background potential V sigma comma 0. Again, I just confirm my earlier result that, and this is interesting, by an inflation it got even more complicated. In the cyclic case, this is just the same. You have a single class of models. This is the typical cyclic background potential. It's a very, usually very steep one, and it flattens out then and turns. Okay. You can make an example. This is a strictly scale-free example, and this is just a negative exponential with a Paolo prefactor that is responsible for the turn. Okay, and this is now the last remark I want to make in my talk, because that was my main aim, having a predictive theory. I got to present that I could even evaluate and compare different cosmologies, but what should decide about my cosmology is always observations. So that was the motivation for my theory, that I can have a theory, or I can have different theories that can be decided by observations. So I could restore predictability, and it also turns out that scale-freeness, scale-free both, scale-free inflation, and scale-free cyclic theory is consistent with current observational data if I allow for background-only scale-freeness too. So for in both cases, alpha equals 1 would lie, wouldn't be the most favored value. How do I perform the test? But I can test for any alphas. So in the future, we want to measure R. But if we measure R, because we have a one-parameter theory, any R measurement will give you a corresponding alpha, and that will give you a corresponding NS. Of course, you can start with measuring NS as we have it now, then determine from there alpha, for example, NS, and then measure R and see if it corresponds. So it can go the other way around as well. Now, if I plot my NS and R curve, I do it now for inflation, because for cyclic, I have no curve since R is always 0. I mean, unobservably so it's not really 0, but almost 0. So I plot this curve for inflation. And the interesting thing is, remember, first we had these complicated potentials with three parameters that could fit any NS minus 1 R values. Now I have a curve where to each NS I have two corresponding R values. And if I cut out now the current observational values up to one sigma deviation, so my mean value is, so the official Planck value was 0.96. As you know, you might have seen the Spragel paper from last week or 2 weeks ago, where they say that there is a problem with the Planck map, and that your also the Planck mean value should be closer to 9.96, 0.97. Then you see that all the R values that are bigger than or above 0.1 are not anymore there within the one sigma bound. And that would mean, again, just what I already pointed out, that inflationary models, the models that are consistent with current data, if you had the scale-free principle, so scale-free inflation, will push you towards the plateau-like models. But it can change if we measure something so interesting. Yes?
Parametric in alpha?
Curve traces different points correspond to different values at alpha.
That's true. So this is, I made the, yes, exactly. Let's get back to my, so this is my test. I just start with, for example, NS. If I give you an NS value, I computed alpha as a function of NS, and I plugged this alpha value into my R formula, and so I got the parametric plot, yes, for NS and R. So each point on this curve corresponds to a concrete value of alpha, and that gives you, so each alpha gives you a single NS and two Rs.
So have you looked at how this curve gets fuzzed out when you change the total number of equals?
You mean if I don't plug the 60 but 50, almost nothing. Yes, I looked at. So I always computed it, what happens when I change 50 or 60. This is really fifth or sixth digit. So this is not helpful. I know that you would want to, so naturally people like to manipulate with 55 or 60. No, the robustness comes from scarceness. So because your alpha is the power, therefore, and so if you compare the formulas, it's a very, just plug NS into Mathematica, take the inverse function for alpha, plug the alpha into R as a function of NS, and it will, and then you can really plug in 50 or 60, even 70. There's almost no difference, really almost no difference.
So if I look at this plot,
mm-hmm.
So if I fix NS,
mm-hmm.
you predict gravitational waves at a minimal value of at a minimal amplitude. So like pick 0.96.
Yes.
Are you saying that this Can class of models always predicts R greater than 10?
Mm-hmm. So I do it this way. Look, I just write it because you might not remember this anymore. So I have, if I assume that my epsilon of n equals, in case of inflation, equals n plus 1 to the alpha, then you either have here 61 to the alpha or 51 to the alpha. Now, NS will correspond here to, if you plug this in, so again, I just remind you to the general formula. And then you can substitute epsilon. And then you get that it's minus alpha over n plus 1 minus 2. Sorry, but this comes from the first member to the alpha. And now you want to compute here the inverse function. And then what I do is, of course, I want to solve for alpha. It's easy to do. And then I can manipulate either for 61 or 51. And from here, I plug in my, so from here I get my, if you wish, alpha ns minus 1 and n. And here I plug in this guy again with the same n. So it's really important. You could cheat, right? You could cheat in plugging here different n than here, but then you would just cheat to the alpha. And then, yes. So basically, I don't need this anymore. It's very important that I get the same alpha from here. And really, I plug this in. If you plot the curve, it doesn't give you much difference. So from here, so I need now both my curve and the formulae. You see, so for example, alpha equals 2 corresponds to 0.96. If you set 60. If you set 50, it will correspond probably to 0.959 or something like this. Or 9, whatever. So really, almost no difference. It is the borderline. Okay, and just let me mention this. This is, so what can we expect? I think it's fair to say, if you don't want to go too far away from your NSYU, so if you don't want to go away 2 sigma, 3 sigma from your NS, then it's fair to say, if R should be lower than 10 to the minus 4, then scarce-free inflation is ruled out. More worrisome is the fact that the models that currently fit the data are all plateau-like, that means, or at the borderline to the intermediate class. And the plateau-like models, so the mostly favored value is now alpha equals 1, they encounter all the problems I pointed out. Plus, and this is really bad news, I was only discussing about solving or restoring predictability in sense of the parameter unpredictability. If you add now the multiverse unpredictability problem, I'm not sure if it's really good news or it's really something that says, think about alternative cosmologies. If scalar-free cyclic cosmology is the right alternative, well, we need a complete theory of the bounds. Up until then, I just think it's fair to say that it's competitive, it behaves at background level differently, and it does not encounter the three problems I pointed out in case of scalar-free inflation, and we know that it doesn't have the runaway behavior, so it doesn't produce a multiverse in the same sense as inflation produces it. But maybe we will measure some kind of R. Maybe this R will be in the range that fits very well to the plateau models. And then I think it will be really amazing to decide if we want to go towards an alternative cosmology that gives you R, but doesn't suffer from multiverse and unpredictability problem and these kinds of problems I discussed in this talk. Or we want to repair inflation, we want to solve the multiverse problem, and we want to find either a fundamental theory or the solutions for this problem within the inflationary paradigm. So in any case, I think it's an amazing time from cosmology, and thank you for your attention.
Question.
Okay.
So you solved a lot of the problems you listed mm-hmm. in the ekpyrotic scenario by mm-hmm. allowing yourself to have two fluids.
Yes.
What happens if I play the same game for the inflationary model? Mm-hmm. So I have a curvaton mm-hmm. type mechanism, mm-hmm. where I have some field mm-hmm. that's responsible for the smoothing and some different mm-hmm. field that's responsible for
yes.
The perturbations.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's a very good question. First of all, we thought about this. The first remark is that the curvaton model is not scalar-free. So what you need to look, if you recall that we had in the Friedmann equation, as soon as we introduce two fluid components, we need two fluid components with the same equation of state. Now there is no curvaton model that gives you that. So in the curvaton case, it doesn't work. Curvaton is not scalar-free. Now you could ask if there is out there, if you could construct an inflationary model that has the same kind of the two epsilons are the same, you have the right tilt. I would say it's definitely possible to construct it. You can assume a multi-field fluid, but it has more parameters. So it has in two sense more parameters. First of all, it has more parameters in the sense that, So if you have here the Friedmann equation, then what you need to do first is to suppress the density perturbations in order to that your isocurve. So if you have here the smoothing fluid component and there is something here plus this first component and then the second component, let's talk about them as epsilon 1 and epsilon 2. Then you know that in the cyclic case you are free from density perturbations. You don't need to be worried about them. Now here it's not the case. They both will produce either curvature perturbations and density perturbations. Now, in order to coordinate the two guys, and it's not anymore the curvaton, so the curvaton would be free of that problem, but that's not scalar-free. But here, because they both have the same equation of state, they both produce density perturbations, you will wish to suppress them in order to be able to have the isocurvature perturbations. So you definitely will have more parameters in order to suppress the density perturbations. And then there is a second, and I think more important question. What's the motivation for this? So in the cyclic model, there is a good physical motivation for isocurvature perturbations. Your density perturbations decay. In the inflationary case, I don't see any motivation for the dominance of isocurvature perturbations compared to density perturbations, since the density we observe density perturbations, so it's an additional complication to the model. So even if you say, somehow I get at least a very small class where I have not more parameters, or somehow I can suppress in a very clever way my density perturbations, you still need to ask yourself, but what is my physical motivation to do so?
I mean, I would argue in both
cases,
it's an empirical motivation. So you introduce the second field in the ekpyrotic scenario because you don't mm-hmm. the empirically correct answer.
Yes.
And so one could say the same about the inflationary models. Maybe you don't like these initial conditions, problems, etc. So you invent a field that solves all those, and then you want to get things empirically right. So you.
But that's not scare-free anymore. Then you have two stages of inflation, right? If you first have what you were talking now about. So here I assume the one continuous stage of inflation, and that's why I'm saying you have a trouble if you want to solve. If they both need to solve your smoothness problem, so your initial conditions problem, and they both need to produce your perturbations, then you have just the same sort of inflationary problems you had there. If you say that you have two stages of inflation in the sense, like in the curvaton, that one field, so there are two stages. In the first stage, you solve the initial conditions problem, say smoothness, homogeneity, and anisotropy. Then you create the perturbations. Then it's not scare-free because you have already two stages. So you added a different complication to the model. These are models they are around there. They are working models, but they are not scare-free. I wanted to consider scare-free inflation. That was the aim.
I wonder, in terms of the theory of initial conditions, mm-hmm. what you thought about or what you think of the, I mean, there's sort of the Hartle-Hawking mm-hmm. proposal. There, the traditional story was that it was a sort of theory of initial conditions that fails one because it wants to predict you, favors universes that have a very low, mm-hmm. if they have a very low mm-hmm. Vacuum energy density instead of high up mm-hmm. potential. But then more recently they want to say that there's a distinction between sort of the probability of a given universe versus the probability that a given observer will observe a certain initial state. They distinguish between these top-down and bottom-up probabilities.
Mm-hmm.
Now they say that the physically relevant top-down probability is for an initial condition is basically the lowest value on potential that's mm-hmm. the eternally inflating machine. I don't know. I have a feeling. Am I?
Okay. So I just know two things. So first of all, they only consider the m square phi square like models, no? In that model, as phi as r, no. And the second thing is that they also need the multiverse. So in order to solve their initial conditions problem, they play around with the Turner inflation, right?
I don't think so. I think you just have a probability distribution predicted by the square of this wave function.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and the wave function of the universe. There is then some implication of how you should solve the quantum gravity problem. So that's, I think, the same. So I'm not an expert on it. I need to admit this. I've heard of this. And I think if their quantum gravity is a good theory, then observation will prove them, then we need to think about that. But m square phi square inflation is, from the microwave background data point of view, is not really favored. So I'm not sure if that model is so good if it only works with m square phi square. This would be my immediate concern. And then the other problem is the quantum gravity. And I'm not a quantum gravity expert. So I just know that this is definitely not the only model that is competitive for being the right theory of quantum gravity. So it makes a huge assumption that it gives you the right quantum gravity. And it works with m square phi square. So I would be suspicious at this point. But more, I think it's...
They often do use m square phi square mm-hmm. papers because they have an analytic solution in that mm-hmm. case. But the argument is supposed to be for any value of any potential. The basic mm-hmm. basic idea is that the they predict an amplitude associated with each universe, which goes as e to the plus 1 over b mm-hmm. at the basic point where inflation start mm-hmm. the potential where inflation started. And so that sounds bad, because that sounds like it favors when b is very small,
mm-hmm.
e to the plus 1 over mm-hmm. b is very large, so they favor universes where the initial b is very small. But they say, so that may be the probability for the universe. universe as a whole, but if a given observer at late time, like you or me, occurs with some finite probability per unit volume, which is, who knows, it doesn't, you don't need to know the exact value, but some probability per unit volume gamma. And then you evaluate, you know, what is the most probable pass according to some such observer, conditioned on the observer.
Okay.
And you get this extra factor, and in particular, you know, if you started high enough up the potential that you were in the eternally inflating regime, and you predict that the reheating surface at the end of inflation diverges, so whatever finite probability you put in at the end per unit volume for an observer to form, when you multiply that times the infinite volume that's been the space that's been created by a terminal inflation, you want to say that that overwhelms the suppression factor.
Okay.
Starting higher up the potential.
Okay, so this is just so this would be more a question because I really didn't work on this theory.
I'm also been trying to figure out whether I believe the argument or not.
I just had this intuitive question first. I would ask is then your theory more about probabilities that lie outside of what your inflationary paradigm can give you? So is it then a more theory of measures in probability? Or does it come naturally out of inflation? I don't see the second option. So I'm not sure how far away you need to get from the very underlying idea of inflation. Does inflation solve the initial conditions problem, or you need to add some additional principle, additional theory, say quantum gravity or whatever, that will give you the right initial conditions, so inflation is really only responsible for preserving them and creating the perturbations.
Yeah,
I cannot,
they,
yes.
They made this proposal.
Yes.
The right initial conditions. It's kind of like a conceptually very economical way to say the theory should sew onto itself in a way that it turns into a theory of initial.
Okay, so I really must admit I need to think more about it. Yes, yes, yes. I just don't. Yes. Okay. Thank you. Okay.
More questions for Anna? Let's speak here again.